The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 89.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He's someone that I've seen on Real Vision. I've been listening to him for a long time on Macro Voices. He has his own podcast. He is a Twin Fit superstar, that is for sure. His name is Jesse Felder. Jesse, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey, George, thanks for having me.
All right. Now, for those of my viewers who might not know your full backstory, it's very fascinating. Can you get us up to speed on that?
Yeah, sure. I right out of college, I went to work for Bear Stearns in the LA office. They sent me back to New York to kind of meet people back there. I got to go to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, meet their floor traders, all that. I started out basically as a ticket runner in the LA office, basically just running tickets to the trading desk for a couple of guys. I found a guy who was basically running a hedge fund inside of Bear Stearns, and I kind of gravitated towards working for him and learned a ton. We ended up leaving and starting our own hedge fund firm in Santa Monica, where we started with about $100 million under management and grew it eventually to, I think, $14, $15 billion, by 2006, 2007. I quit the firm in 2000, really right at the peak of the dot-com mania. I just kind of had the program in a variety of different ways and started at that point doing my own thing. And that's where I've kind of been doing ever since.
Okay. Now you're just able to think very clearly in one of my favorite places on earth, and that's Bend, Oregon.
It's a great place to live. Yeah, when we were leaving L.A., my son was born in, like, he was a millennium baby. He was born in 99, just November 99. We said, where do we want to raise a family? And we looked at a bunch of different places, and Bend was, okay, this is a great place for raising a family and, where I just love to live. So, yeah, I've been here for just over 20 years.
Okay, great. Now let's go to your blog. And if anyone is wondering what to read over the next year, 2 years, whatever, what to read right now, you got to check out Jesse's blog. It is absolutely incredible. One of the things I love the most about it is I'm someone that's extremely busy, and your blog posts are just quick, bam, right to the point. You've got a chart, you've got a couple charts, and you just hit some bullet points and boom, there you go. So it's easy to digest a lot of information quickly, but let's go over your most recent blog post. I think it was regarding the Buffett indicator, because I've done a lot of videos on that. And I'd just like to hear you expand as much as you'd like to on that, on those charts that you had in there in the whole blog post.
Sure. Well, there was this indicator comes from, I think it was the 2001, in around the dot-com mania, Buffett wrote a couple of pieces for Fortune magazine, one in late 99 and one again in, I think, early 2001. And this one comes from that 2001 piece where he talked about this indicator being the best single indicator to try to understand equity valuations at any given moment. And essentially, it's the total value of the stock market relative to the total size of the economy. I kind of look at it as like a price to sales measure for the whole stock market. But when you look at this thing, you can see in the dot-com mania, it just went off the chart. We got pretty expensive actually in the late 60s, 67, 68. But the 2000 dot-com mania, this measure soared far above anything we'd seen since the 1929 stock market peak. My data doesn't go back that far, but I've seen studies that show essentially the 2000 peak was very similar to 1929. But what's happened over the last, 3-4 years is valuations have actually, breached that peak in 2000, and the stock market's become more expensive in the last couple of years than it was even at the peak of the dot-com mania. So, and with this stock market rally and falling GDP at the same time, we've seen, this valuation metric go back or surpass its all-time highs. So stocks are extremely overvalued, which is, by not all measures would say that. You'd look at, trailing PEs and, other things that people like to look at. But to me, this measure is the best. And the reason it's so good is because it's highly has a high negative correlation with forward 10-year returns in the stock market. Wow. So when you turn this measure upside down, it's very highly correlated with forward 10-year returns. And so right now, basically this measure is saying returns, you know, should be negative for the stock market for the coming 10 years, which it's rarely, you know, given such a message, you know, in, like I said, the 2000 peak, it forecast, you know, negative 2% per year return. And it's exactly what we saw from 2000 to 2010. So I think, you know, that's the message the stock market is sending us right now, is that stocks are extremely overvalued.
How does this indicator work in a world that where a lot of these corporations are making more and more money overseas?
Well, you can, you know, my friend John Hussman has done some work where he basically includes foreign revenues of domestic companies, and it doesn't change the measure at all, really. It's a very, very minor change. So that's what some people would argue is, you know, the GDP doesn't include that. But actually, this measure is GNP, gross national product. So it's really does show the revenues earned by domestic corporations. And I guess that's the difference between GNP and GDP, is most people look at market cap to GDP. But, you know, Buffett said he looks at GNP. So that's kind of just one of the minor, you know, differences there. So I would say this measure, by using gross national product, it does include foreign, you know, revenues generated by domestic owners.
Okay. Got it. And then how do you use the CAPE ratio in addition to this Buffett indicator?
Well, the CAPE ratio is a really good one. You know, Robert Shiller won a Nobel Prize for a lot of the work that, you know, in developing the CAPE ratio. To me, the CAPE ratio is good because it's, you know, usually people just look at a simple price to earnings ratio, 1 year's worth of earnings relative to the current price, whether that's forward earnings or last year's earnings. The problem, though, is a lot of the times you can be looking at peak earnings. And so if you look at any cyclical stocks, like individual stocks, you usually want to buy them when they're really expensive and sell them when they're really cheap. And why would that be? It's because the earnings cycle is such that when they have really good earnings, you're near the peak of the cycle. And so those stocks deserve to trade at kind of a cheaper valuation on those peak earnings. And at the bottom of the cycle, earnings collapse. And so you really want, you should be comfortable paying a high multiple in that environment. And that's usually what it looks like when those types of stocks bottom. So Shiller wanted to develop an earnings measure that would include a full cycle worth of earnings. So right. The cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio is a 10-year average of earnings. The trouble with the CAPE ratio that I have today is that it shows the last 10 years worth of earnings, but that doesn't include a recession anymore. We just dropped off that 2009-10 earnings recession. And so now we only show, now it shows stocks are not as extremely overvalued as something like the Buffett yardstick, because it only shows earnings during a cyclical uptrend. Right. It doesn't actually show a recession anymore. So to me, that measure right now, you know, is not quite as valuable as some like the Buffett measure.
Okay. And I know, going back to your recent interview with Keith McCullough, which I'd strongly suggest anyone listening to if they get the opportunity, he brought up something where I guess his guys look at the same indicator with corporate debt included. And if you look at how expensive the market is, how expensive the CAPE ratio is telling us, then you add on corporate debt, then it really looks ugly.
Yeah. So one of my favorite measures when I'm looking at individual stocks would be something like EBIT to, or enterprise value to EBIT. And so enterprise value would be the equity value plus the debt value. And to me, that's, you know, my friend Toby Carlisle's done a bunch of great work. That's how an acquirer would look at buying a company, right? Because when you buy a whole company, right, you either get the cash on the balance sheet or you have to assume the net debt on that company's balance sheet. So It really makes sense to integrate that into your valuation approach. And you can do that with the Buffett yardstick. Also, something I look at, you know, basically just take all the debt securities out there, add them to all the equity securities, and divide by GNP, or as my friend John Hussman does, use gross value added, which is kind of a revenue metric for all of corporate America. So yeah, I mean, that's really important because corporate leverage is off the charts this cycle. And so if you're not looking at debt, then a lot of these stocks and the broad market, in fact, can look cheaper than it otherwise would.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, AT&T comes to mind, and I watch Real Vision all the time, and I know there's kind of like five main stocks that just have an incredible amount of debt on their balance sheet right now. Going back to your blog, you had a post on why this time you might want to fight the Fed. So can you explain that a little further?
Well, there's So on the blog, I've written essentially two posts relative to this topic. Okay. The one that I titled, you know, Fight the Fed, was really in regards to these issues that are now kind of behind a lot of the social unrest. I mean, a lot of it is related to Black Lives Matter and for good reason. But I think a lot of it is just due to other types of inequalities, wealth inequality, income inequality, inequality of opportunities. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, one of is just we've changed our regulatory framework so we don't pursue antitrust as strongly as we did in the past. The Chicago School of Economics has argued successfully to the government, suggesting that, you know, corporate consolidation is not really a problem. But when you look at why labor share of income is at record lows and staying there, you know, a lot of that has to do with corporate consolidation and corporations just gaining, you know, much more of an upper hand on labor. Part of that is also due to globalization, offshoring of jobs, you know, with that huge new supply of labor coming in as a part of globalization, that's given labor much less bargaining power. But I think people overlook the role that the Fed has played in all of this, too, right, in that, you know, the Fed has been tasked with creating full and sustaining full employment. But their only tool for doing that is through the capital markets. And so, you know, personally, I believe it's impossible to try and boost labor at the expense of capital by only doing it through the capital markets. And that's exactly what the Fed is trying to do. And so the Fed has essentially been boosting capital at the expense of labor under the guise of doing it for the labor, you know, the labor class. And so, people need to look at the Fed's role here, because it's been huge. I mean, for so long, for the last 10 years, they've told us we're trying to create a wealth effect in the economy, but we have no role in wealth inequality. It's incredibly disingenuous. And so I think, you know, that's something important to look at, is the sociological effects of, you know, Fed policy. But also I've written, too, about liquidity. And, you know, people think don't fight the Fed when they're injecting so much liquidity into the markets. And the trouble with that is liquidity is not just what the Fed's doing. It's also what the Treasury is doing. And the Treasury has to meet the needs of the federal government. And so, you know, from a standpoint of net liquidity, it makes much more sense to look at, okay, the Fed is printing, let's say, $1 billion. If the Treasury is issuing less than $1 billion in net new debt, then that's net liquidity that's going to come into the financial markets. But once the Treasury starts outpacing, you know, Fed activity, that positive liquidity can actually turn into negative liquidity, where the Treasury begins to suck up all the liquidity the Fed is putting into the market, and then some. And we're actually at that point now, where I think the run rate, you know, the Fed balance sheet has been expanding $60-70 billion a week. And now the Treasury has been needing over $100 billion, issuing $100 billion per week, you know, over the last few weeks. And so we've actually entered that period of net negative liquidity for the markets, which is not the positive that most, I think, traders assume it to be right now.
Right. And can you explain to my viewers, Jesse, what would happen if the Fed didn't step in and buy those treasuries? I mean, I know they go through the primary dealers and it's kind of a shell game to a certain extent. But if the Fed just, if they didn't provide as much liquidity as they do for those treasuries?
Well, to me, it's simple supply and demand, right? Yeah. You know, there's the supply of financial assets that are out there, and then there's demand on the part of investors to buy them. And, you know, the supply of those financial assets changes, you know, based on a few different factors. Most importantly, over the last 10 years, is we've seen, you know, net buybacks by corporations that's, you know, reduced the supply of equities. That's also changing right now, where we're seeing the largest issuance from you know, corporations selling stock in the open market. in a long, long time. But, you know, treasury issuance has a big part, you know, role to play in this too, that when treasury issuance is expanding, that's new financial asset supply coming into the market.
Right.
And so if the demand is not there to meet that new supply, then prices have to go down. And that would mean interest rates going up, which means, higher cost of capital for corporations. And it also means a higher risk-free rate that's competing with equity. So, if the Fed is not in there soaking up this excess supply, then all else being equal, prices have to go down for risk-free assets, which means risk assets probably have to go down too.
Yeah. And the government is going to be paying a higher price on their debt, which would be very problematic, to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, I think, there have been a few economists talking about the potential for a fiscal crisis going forward. And I think that that's an underrated risk right now too, that, there's a difference between the QE that's happening now and the QE that was that's happened over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, it was, let's buy up treasuries so that investors holding these treasuries have to go into riskier assets. They have to go buy corporate bonds, go buy stocks, and boost the prices of those assets to try and create a wealth effect to make people feel wealthier and boost the economy. What's happened, I think, really since the crisis that we had last fall in the repo markets, is the Fed has had to come in not to try and support the economy, but to just soak up this excess supply, that there's not enough demand for the new treasury issuance out there. And so the Fed has been forced to monetize the debt. And I wrote about this back in the fall, that this is just an outright monetization of the debt. And it's very different type of QE than what we saw, in the 10 years prior.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've watched some videos that the Bank of England has uploaded to YouTube. And they just come right out and say, listen, the goal of quantitative easing is to increase asset prices. And for some reason, the Fed is a lot less transparent, let's say.
Yeah. Well, actually, the Fed was pretty transparent early on in QE1, too. They were talking about wealth effects. But it's important that the message has changed recently. And I think that, to me, I've written several times over the, since the start of the year, the first market comment I wrote this year was, this is going to be the year to watch the dollar. Because if this narrative changes, that QE is not necessarily to support the asset markets, it's now the Fed is beholden to the Treasury. I mean, we're now seeing fiscal dominance where the Fed is forced to come in and monetize the debt, because if they didn't, there would be a fiscal crisis. As that narrative, starts to take hold and grow, like I think it will, the outlet for a lot of these activities will be the dollar. And so I think the dollar is the most important chart in the world right now to pay attention to, because if people start coming around to this idea that the Fed has to monetize the debt because there's no other way to pay for it, there's not the demand out there around the world to buy treasuries, then the dollar will really, potentially face another major bear market. I mean like a 30-40% decline over the next several years, which would have major implications for a lot of different things.
Jesse, when you're thinking about inflation, I'm assuming you're talking about consumer price inflation, because there's so many areas where inflation can show up. But in my mind, I always look at base money. So the Fed is, let's call it, printing bank reserves. But then in order for those bank reserves to actually have an effect on M2, the broad money, then the commercial banks, the retail banks have to do something, or the government has to just do this massive deficit spending. So how do you see that in your mind as far as the role that the Fed plays with base money, and then the role they play in the past with M2, if there's causation or correlation there? And then moving forward, do you think they might bypass some of the rules, kind of wink, wink, nod, to have more control over M2, therefore maybe even create this inflation in order to kind of bail out the government from their debt load?
Well, I think that's exactly what's going on right now, is the Fed is, their greatest fear is deflation. And, inflation is very highly correlated to GDP, at least core inflation is. And so you see, GDP plummeting. I mean, this is the worst quarter of GDP we're in the midst of right now since the Great Depression. And so you're seeing core inflation respond. Core inflation is dropping like a rock. And so I think the Fed sees it as their duty to, especially with as much debt as we have at a corporate level, at a government level, at a consumer level, that they could just not allow for deflation. So this liquidity push that they've made is the biggest liquidity injection in the history of the Federal Reserve. So that to me is, yes, they see the risk of deflation and they see the risk of the economy going into kind of a deflationary spiral and have, you know, taken steps to ensure that we'll get inflation going forward. But I do think over the short run, we are going to see, you know, inflation drop off. But there are a lot of longer term, you know, to me, it's fascinating how this works, because there are a lot of longer term things that are trends that I pay attention to that are pointing towards inflation over the next 5 years, you know, starting to take off again. And the Fed is only going to exacerbate those right now. I mean, I think, you know, Powell said, low inflation is, you know, the greatest challenge of our time, something similar to that, you know, maybe a year ago. And to me that, you know, I think he sees himself as the reverse I'm spacing on his Volcker, Paul Volcker.
Oh, right.
Paul Volcker was supposed to, you know, inflation was, he had to raise short rates to 20% to kind of break the back of inflation. I think Powell sees himself as the reverse Volcker. It's my job to get inflation going again. And I think that's exactly what they're doing.
Do you think they'll try to just peg the yield curve, let inflation run hot, and then try to somehow finagle the CPI numbers to make it seem like we're not running at 7, 8, 9, 10% inflation?
Well, the CPI numbers are already finagled. I mean, there's websites you can look at that show, like, if you calculated CPI the same way we did in 1990, we're already looking at 5-6% inflation right now. So they're already, you know, with hedonics and all these other things and owner's equivalent rent, and, you know, the CPI numbers are already completely fooled with. I don't know if they'll try and fool with them any more than that, but I do think that they're trying to get inflation to a place where, you know, it's going to sustain itself higher. And even once it does start taking off, kind of allowing an inflationary mindset to take hold among consumers. That's really what I think they want to happen, to ensure that deflation's, or disinflation is not going to become a problem.
Yeah, I know you talked about that with Keith briefly. Could you expand on how important psychology is to inflation? And I'm assuming it's important because of velocity.
Well, you know, it's really hard. You know, inflation is very difficult for economists or anyone to understand, you know, where it comes from. You know, I mean, a lot of people thought we would have had inflation over the last 10 years that would have really taken off as a part of all the money printing. It really was only inflation in asset prices, and it didn't make itself visible, at least in the economy and in consumer inflation. But, I do think that the inflationary mindset is really, really critical to, how inflation operates. That if people believe, prices are going to be lower or at least the same a year from now, they have no incentive to go spend and buy today. In fact, they have an incentive to wait. If they think prices are going to be lower, a year from now, you have an incentive to wait. The longer you wait, the less money you're going to pay. But when an inflationary mindset takes hold, it becomes self-fulfilling, because people think, prices are going to be higher a year from now, so I better hurry up and buy today. And that increased demand from an inflationary dynamic kind of creates a rise in prices on its own and kind of creates a self-reinforcing inflationary dynamic. And so that's, I think, what the Fed is thinking, is that, either one of those mindsets can be dangerous, but they would prefer it to be an inflationary mindset rather than a deflationary mindset.
Do you think that mindset that you just described is more applicable to assets than consumer prices? Because whenever I go back and forth with like a deflationist argument, like from a Keynesian standpoint, I see, a lot of people are still going to buy gas, they're going to buy food, they're still going to buy healthcare, they're going to buy education. But if you think that the real estate prices, as an example, will be lower in a year, then you definitely hold off buying a house.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely applies to asset prices. I think, I've heard over the past year or two or three, from some investors That argument for buying stocks, that we are going to enter a hyperinflationary environment and the stock market's only going to go crazy higher because of that. And so I do think it plays into assets. Real estate's probably a really good example, like you said. But I think it plays into, you know, consumer prices as well. I think a lot of consumers have been trained over the last, you know, 20 years that, you know, TV prices go down, you know, technology price, computer prices go down. A lot of these things that we buy only go down in price over time. And so that's been a real disinflationary mindset dynamic among consumers too. Now, if that ever changes, you know, part of one of these longer term trends that I've mentioned, I think is going to exacerbate inflationary tendencies, is this trend from globalization to deglobalization. Right. So, globalization has allowed us to go produce things overseas much cheaper, and that's allowed, you know, TV prices and all these things to go down, and not to mention, you know, the natural Moore's law and things. But I do think if we go, we are already going from a globalization trend to a deglobalization trend, or reshoring of labor, reshoring of production. And that's going to be very costly if that trend takes off. And the cost of a lot of things are going to go way up. I mean, Apple said, you know, iPhone would probably cost twice what it does if we produce them in the United States. And
really?
So,
wow.
You know, I think if we do come back to these types of reshoring things, and to me, it looks like this was already a trend before coronavirus. We saw it in parts, you know, of the trade war. But now with the virus, we're seeing an even bigger, you know, more incentive, a greater push towards reshoring of a lot of these things. That's a dynamic that will boost, you know, labor costs and a lot of other things that will it'll make for this shift back in the other direction towards labor and away from capital, which is also an inflationary dynamic.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. And it could reduce the supply, because to set up those supply chains domestically, it doesn't happen overnight. So you've got the increased labor costs, increasing the prices of the stuff that is produced here. And then you've got this long runway as far as time that's reducing the supply that could exacerbate that problem further, I would imagine. How do you look at your view, or what, first of all, what is your long-term view on the dollar? I'm assuming it's down, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. And then how would you juxtapose that position to Brent Johnson and all of the fantastic things that he brings up when you look at the debt, the dollar-denominated debt outside of the United States?
Brent's a friend of mine, and I have a ton of respect for him, but we just disagree on the dollar. He's also another person who thinks stock prices go way higher over the next few years, and I disagree with that too. I do think that for me, my investment framework comes down to three or four things. It's really fundamentals, sentiment, and technicals. And there's also macro you can throw in there too. Todd Harrison has called these the four pillars of investing or trading. So for me, you know, what's the fundamentals for the dollar? Fundamentals are it's pretty significantly overvalued against almost any other currency on the planet. Take your pick, euro, yen, Chinese yuan. These things are all dramatically undervalued relative to the dollar. Whether you look at, you know, something like the Big Mac Index or any type of purchasing power parity, dollar is overvalued, significantly overvalued. But the other major fundamental for the dollar is the U.S. fiscal situation. So you look at the direction of the dollar of the last 25 years, and it's very highly correlated to the fiscal deficit relative to GDP. So when last time we had a surplus was in the late 90s, early 2000s. That was when the dollar hit a major peak. When the dot-com bust happened, there was a big hole in tax revenues, and the deficit blew out, and the dollar rolled over into a major bear market that didn't end until 2009-10-ish. You know, when the deficit was blowing out as a part of the financial crisis. So the deficit over the last couple of years went over $1 trillion. And it's the first time since 1968 that we've had a significant fiscal deficit in the middle of an economic expansion, or at least during an economic expansion.
It's the greatest economy of all time, Jesse. Right. Don't you know that?
Exactly. So, but in 68, it was because of the Vietnam War and other things that Nixon, you know, was doing. And we only had a deficit of 2.5% of GDP. It hit 5% last year. And so this is twice as big as the Nixon precedent. What happened after 68? Well, there was the other things going on, but that fiscal profligacy ended up in rampant inflation for the next 10 plus years. I think we saw this blowout in the deficit over the last couple of years, and now it's, you know, making the last couple of years look like, you know, nothing. This $1 trillion deficit is turning into a $3 trillion deficit. We're going to hit 18 or 20% of GDP on the deficit, something that we haven't seen since, you know, World War II. So to me, this is a very, very bearish fundamental for the dollar. It couldn't be more bearish. And if the dollar does follow the deficit as a major fundamental, the dollar's, you know, on the verge of another major bear market. And, you know, that's why I said I think a 40% decline over the next 3 to 5 years is not at all out of the question. We can get into sentiment and technicals too, but to me, the fundamentals are the primary thing to watch for long term.
Okay, so the bottom line is we've got a lot of cross currents with anything, especially in macro. So you understand Brent's position and the fundamentals he's talking about with this dollar denominated debt outside the United States, but you just think the deficits, they're going to have to print so much money, they're going to peg the yield curve, that's going to have more power than the other cross current of the dollar denominated debt.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me is, you know, there's this idea that I've heard Brent talk about and some others, is that, you know, this essentially represents a huge short position on the dollar, this overseas debt that has to be covered, paid back. They need dollars to pay it back. The one distinction I would make between a short position and debt is that a short position has to be bought back. Your broker will buy you in at some point if you run out of money. Debt doesn't have to be paid back. Debts, you know, a lot of times don't get paid back. And so I think that's probably what will happen with a lot of this, is that, you know, those debts just won't get paid back. They won't, those, you know, people who are, you know, owing money in dollars are just not going to ever buy those dollars back. So it's not technically a short position in my view. And I think that's the flaw of that argument.
Okay. Fantastic. Let's keep moving on. I know that we're just going back a little bit here. We were talking about how the projections, the forecasts for the next 10 years are negative for the stock market when you look at the Buffett indicator and the, possibly the CAPE ratio as well. How do you think corporate taxes play into that? Because when I look at the 2020 election, let's just assume for a moment that Trump doesn't get reelected. If you've got someone on the left coming in, assuming they take corporate taxes up to where they were, let's say, and then maybe they increase the capital gains tax, how would that play into corporate profits first and foremost? And then how would that affect the market and how they see the future earnings and therefore the entire S&P?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. It comes back to, you know, this Buffett quote that I was talking about that he wrote about. And the reason the Buffett yardstick has been able to go to record highs and surpass those we saw during the dot-com mania is because it's basically like a price-to-sales measure. And the reason that it looks so much more expensive than some price-to-earnings measures is that corporate profit margins have expanded to their widest in history. This is the opposite of that labor share of income that I was talking about before. So labor share has gone down to record lows. Corporate profits have gone up to record highs. And so part of that, you know, is the globalization and dynamics that we talked about where labor costs have just been able to go way down and stay down. But part of it is corporate taxes. Part of it's interest rates. You know, all these things play into corporate profit margins, you know, going into record highs. And so I do think that with record high profits, you have to be extremely careful at looking at a basic price to earnings ratio because it assumes profit margins are going to stay at record highs forever. Right. Jeremy Grantham has called profit margins the most mean reverting series in finance. Now, that's not proven to be true over the last 20 years. They've profit margins have stayed really high. But like I said, there's tons of these forces that look like profit margins are going to have to come way down and labor share is going to go way up over the next 10 years. Part of that is probably taxes, right? How are we going to pay for all this new debt? It seems to me that it's only logical that politicians, whether you're right or left, I mean, the left wants to do it right away, but the right's going to be forced to do it at some time, which is raise taxes on corporations, because the tax cuts from, you know, a couple of years ago lowered the corporate tax rate to the lowest in history. And so when we're looking for how do we raise revenue, it's going to be part of that. But there's also this deglobalization is going to also affect corporate profit margins as labor share comes back. And right. then if we get inflation, rising interest rates, rising cost of capital for corporations, it's also going to put pressure on profit margins. And so if it turns out that today's S&P 500 earnings or yesterday's whatever is 150, 180 bucks a share are completely unsustainable because of profit margins, and that earnings 10 years from now are going to be the flat, you know, flat to this or even lower, then what kind of a multiple do you put on those? You certainly right. don't put a record high multiple on earnings that have been flat for 10, 20 years and are going to stay, you know, low because of trend, you know, reverting corporate profit margins. And so nobody's really paying attention to this, except for I saw, you know, Ray Dalio a couple of years ago wrote Bridgewater wrote an interesting piece on why they believe profit margins are just beginning to revert to a mean, and that's going to put a, you know, be a major headwind for equity prices going forward. So I mean, this is what the Buffett yardstick's telling us. It tells us in a much, you know, simpler way that returns are probably going to be negative in stocks over the next 10 years, and a big, I guess how to explain that is profit margins are going to revert to a mean. If that happens, then today's prices are going to look extremely expensive. And that's what the Buffett yardstick is showing, that PE measures don't really show.
Right. And then the person with the rebuttal would say, Jesse, but it just doesn't matter, because even though, you know, you take the PE, you take the fundamentals, it's all about liquidity. It's all about the Fed printing money or bank reserves. And then your response to that, I would assume, would be at some point the Fed's not going to be able to do that because inflation is going to prevent them. But then can they just allow inflation to run hot and just say, forget it, we're not going to worry about it. We're just going to keep printing money regardless of the rate of inflation.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's two answers to that. One is the Fed is now in a race with the Treasury, that the Fed has to print more money than the Treasury needs in order to boost the stock, boost the markets.
That's it, right. I got it.
That's the net liquidity. So if the Treasury has to issue $3 trillion of new debt this year, you know, to fund this fiscal deficit, the Fed is going to have to print at least that much and on a sustainable, you know, pace. They have expanded the balance sheet $3 trillion. So that's kind of what Stan Druckenmiller was talking about a couple of weeks ago, is that this huge, you know, expansion of $3 trillion in the balance sheet created a huge liquidity in the short run. But now the Treasury is going to start needing that $3 trillion, and the Fed's already tapering down to, you know, $60 billion a week. And so that dynamic is shifting. So if the Fed really wants to boost asset prices, they're going to have to, you know, re-expand that quantitative easing, those asset purchases, to keep liquidity from going deeply negative over the next few months. The other side of that is, if the Fed decides to do that and says, okay, we're going to do whatever it takes to prop up the markets, like I said, I think the outlet for that's going to be the dollar. And so if you see the dollar start to roll over in response to the Fed's, you know, extreme, you know, interventionist policies, then inflation can pick up, but a falling dollar is going to exacerbate all those inflationary pressures, where all the things we import from overseas become more expensive. And the narrative is going to turn to the Fed is forced to monetize the debt, everybody get out of dollars. And that's when the Fed would maybe be forced to say, okay, we can't just print all this money to fund the Treasury, because we have to come and support the dollar at some point. We can't let it just crash, you know, to incredible lows, because it'll have too many negative implications for the dollar as reserve currency, you know, and tons of other things. And so if the dollar starts tanking, the Fed will be forced to rethink a lot of these policies and say, well, maybe we have to rein in some of this money printing in order to support the currency. And so a lot of people say, you know, there's an unlimited amount of money printing the Fed can do. I would say it's limited by the amount overseas, you know, global investors are willing to hold dollars. At some point, they'll say, no. My friend Bill Fleckenstein has said at some point, the bond market will take the printing press away from the Fed. I think at some point, the currency markets will take the printing press away, and people will just abandon dollars.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I know you do a lot of research on insider buying and selling. Can you walk us through why that's so important and what you've seen over the last couple months?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I really was introduced to early on in my career. It's legal insider trading. I don't really pay much attention to institutional trading or even directors of companies buying and selling. I want to see what the CEO is doing, what the CFO is doing, chief marketing officer, chief technology officer, you know, these types of things. And it was really interesting. In late March, we saw insider buying really, really soar. There was tons of buying. It wasn't in the names that have been leading the market over the last few years, though. It's not been in any tech stocks. It's been a lot of these super deep value names and sectors. We saw a lot of buying in energy, and energy's had a terrific run off the lows. But since the market has, you know, rallied over the past, you know, 2 months plus, we've seen all that buying dry up. It's essentially gone away. I haven't really seen any buying to speak of over the last couple of weeks. We've seen a lot more insider selling. My friend Asif Surya has a great website. He tracks a lot of the stuff, puts out a free weekly newsletter. It's called InsideArbitrage.com. And he noted, I think it was Allegiant Air had a huge CEO just sold a ton of stock last week. We're seeing insider selling really take off again. To me, some of the most interesting selling that I've been seeing is in some of the big private equity funds, so managers. Apollo and Ares are two in particular, where I'm just seeing private equity guys just unload their stock in their private equity firms, which to me, that is a really, really good signal for the credit cycle. I mean, Apollo, for example, has gone from doing nothing, all in just private equity, doing nothing in credit until the last 10 years getting into the credit markets. They're one of the, I think, biggest shadow banks around. They went from zero to $200 billion debt portfolio. And so they have their finger on the pulse of the credit markets. They see what's exactly what's going on in credit. And these guys are selling like there's no tomorrow in a lot of cases, which tells me that they don't expect a lot of these firms to survive. There's going to be bankruptcies. The credit cycle has turned. There's really nothing the Fed can do about it. I've been surprised to see very, very little talk about the insider selling in private equity right now.
A lot of people listening to this will say, Jesse, this is making total sense. I mean, I need to run out right now and short the market as fast as I possibly can. But I know you would maybe hesitate with encouraging them to do that. Can you expand on that?
Well, you know, short selling, I like to say, is the double black diamond of investing. It's the most difficult, dangerous thing you can do in the markets, because, you know, when you buy something, you have limited downside and unlimited upside. Shorting something is the opposite. You have limited upside and unlimited downside. And I've seen friends of mine, you know, blow up their accounts, blow up hedge funds, with just one short position. And so it can be very painful. Charlie Munger's, you know, said about he and Warren Buffett, they don't short sell because they don't like trading agony for money. Right. So I don't ever encourage anybody to try and learn how to short sell. That said, to me, it looks like it's really the only major opportunity right now is short selling a lot of these things that have, I mean, some of these major growth stocks that people are flocking to are trading at their highest valuations in 10 years. At the same time, their sales growth is plummeting. And to me, that's just a recipe for a big decline in the stock market. I see a lot of parallels to 2000, to the dot-com bust. And I think that's probably what investors are looking at going forward over the next few years. But short selling, very, very difficult. And I would encourage anybody who wants to learn to trade at all, whether it's short selling, create an account, a separate account, And say, you know, put in only an amount of money in that you're willing to lose all of it. Because sometimes, I mean, you read about every great trader on the planet and they've all gone broke. Paul Tudor Jones, for example, gone broke 2, 3, 4 times before they've actually figured out, you know, discipline and you know, how to limit risk in those types of trades. So, you know, if it's something that people are interested in learning, just make sure you limit yourself in the amount you're willing to lose. And then know that you're going to lose money and look at it as tuition at the school of trading. I think that's an important way to look at it.
Yeah, going back to your buddy Bill Fleckenstein, who's one of the best short sellers probably of all time, I have listened to a lot of his content as well. And I know even the last few years, he hasn't gone short. He's gone short by going long gold and gold miners. So if he's doing that, maybe that's something the average Joe should consider doing as well. I remember in your interview with Keith, you talked about being kind of boots on the ground in the thick of things in 2000 and seeing people, the retail side, really get excited about the market. But back then, there were actual maybe some reasons, some macro drivers, some fundamental reasons. And comparing that to now, with these people, you know, the millennials going in, let's say with the Robin Hood accounts, that's kind of the stereotype we all think of. But now they're going in, maybe doing the same thing, but there's a lot fewer fundamental reasons to actually be bullish, and this could really be dangerous right now.
Well, you know, back in 2000, we had terrific productivity. We had terrific economic growth. We had the invention of the internet, which is essentially a new gold rush. It was very, very exciting, and it was all real. I mean, those were real positive things for the economy, for corporations, and so there was this you know, real driver of euphoria that we saw. You know, I was the head trader at our hedge fund. We had our own broker dealer. I remember talking with guys that wanted to trade through our firm, and you know, for example, we had a guy who was a stuntman, you know, in Hollywood, and he gave up his job as a stuntman to day trade a lot of these things. And I watched him turn his account, you know, like grow it by 3, 4, 5-fold in, you know, 12 months time and think he was a genius and then, you know, lose it all in the bust. But at least then there was this real excitement. As Jeremy Grantham just pointed out, we're in the top maybe 1% of equity valuations in history, and we're in the bottom 1% of economic outcomes in history. It's the hugest dichotomy I think we've ever seen between the stock market and the economy. And it's, I mean, in the midst of this, you have retail traders coming in, opening new accounts at, you know, Robinhood, E-Trade, Ameritrade, all these places like never before. And, you know, like my friend Jason Gefford pointed out last week, at the peak in February, we saw these small traders buy 7 million call options, you know, right before the crash. Last week, they bought 12 million call options. So the euphoria and the bullishness has even eclipsed what we saw back in February before the stock market crash. I have no problem saying this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my career. It's because the fundamentals for the stock market and the economy are so bad in the midst of this euphoria. It's really difficult to understand and explain.
But, you know, you talked about another thing with Keith that was extremely interesting, and that's that the job market has been so poor for millennials over the past few years. And they're seeing this potentially as just their only way out, like their only way to grow their wealth or to actually make a little bit of money or increase their purchasing power. Can you expand on that? And then I know you really have taken deep dives into the psychological effect of social media. So when you're talking about the millennials and what they're doing right now, going to the market, maybe because the job market isn't as good as it otherwise or it normally is, how is that compounded by social media like Instagram, where they're sitting there seeing all these people post these pictures of the rented Lamborghinis, the champagne, you know, hanging out with all the ladies or whatever it is? And then do you think that really exacerbates the willingness to take risk and to take that stimulus check from the government and go all in on an oil ETF or an airline ETF?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's a lot less millennials seeing that this is their only chance for, you know, some type of financial salvation. It's a lot more of the latter of what you talked about.
Okay.
I'm going to botch the JP Morgan quote, but you said something like, there's nothing that so undermines a man's, you know, ability to be rational as seeing his neighbor get rich. When you see somebody, you know, come back to the housing bubble, and you think, you know, you've seen so many people flip houses and buy, you know, pull equity out of their house and buy seven, you know, spec homes, and you see people making fortunes. That's what literally inspires so many other people to say, okay, I got to buy a spec house. I got to, you know, leverage up my equity on my primary to get crazy and try and make more money. It's the same thing in the dot-com mania. We're seeing it now today, but it also surrounds this. I guess there's this narrative out there, and Robert Shuler has written about this recently through his book Narrative Economics, is that after the 2009 stock market crash, the rally was so strong and so powerful. I think, you know, we got back to those 2007 peak in like, you know, 2 years or something. And so there's been this kind of narrative, this belief that these are terrific buying opportunities. Whenever you see the stock market go down, you have to step in and buy because you'll always be made whole. Market will always come back. And it's this buy the dip mentality that has just become more and more you know, ingrained in people's minds. And the longer that it's been around, the more and more people feel like I've missed out. I've missed my opportunity to buy. You know, when the late 2018 market crashed into, you know, basically Christmas Eve, I think bottomed, but it came like ripping straight back. And, you know, this is, I mean, we've seen it again now. Market crash, fastest crash, you know, 1 month, whatever it is, 10%, 20%, 30% crash from a new high we just saw, and the market's come, you know, NASDAQ is now up above its peak. So all of this action and, you know, the Fed's intervention has kind of ingrained in investors' minds that you have to buy the dip. Yeah, and it's become so pervasive on social media, as you mentioned, that, you know, I can't remember her name, Rana Foroohar, who writes for Financial Times. She wrote a great piece about it a couple weeks ago. Her 12-year-old son asked her if he could open up a Robinhood account because he wanted to buy the dip. Well, and I asked her, I said, 12 years old. I mean, she goes, it's all over their social media. It's on TikTok. It's on, you know, all these different things. People talking about buying the dip and how they're making ungodly amounts of money. The Davy Day Trader, you know, thing is another just example of it. You look at this guy, you know, and he's taken, you know, money out that he got out of selling, you know, Barstool Sports, and he's put it into a day trading account.
Yeah, I just saw that guy today. Yeah, Lynn Alden. I read her most recent research paper. I didn't even know he was a thing. And I looked him up on Twitter, and I saw some of his most recent tweets. And I said, wow, if this isn't the biggest contrarian indicator I've ever seen. He's literally got tweets saying, you know, should I buy or should I sell? Stocks always go up. And it's just
stocks always go up. Hashtag infinity money. You know, I'm the greatest day trader who ever lived. I mean, all these people are watching him and going, oh, my God, he is making, you know, $300,000 a day. He made $1 million today, you know, trading this, you know, trading account, buying Spirit Airlines and what have you. It was really, to me, reminiscent of, you know, like Tokyo Joe. There were these, you know, bulletin boards back in the day in the late 90s where guys would put up, you know, stock ideas, and then you'd see the stock go nuts for the next week. And that's what we're seeing on Reddit. That's what we're seeing with Davy Day Trader. I mean, it's really, really reminiscent. And it's this fear of missing out on a huge opportunity that is driving, I mean, record, unbelievable. I mean, we used to see maybe 2 or 3 million call options bought a week by these traders, you know, over time. Going back to 2000, we saw 12 million calls, you know, bought last week. It's completely off the charts.
Wow. All right. Well, in the sake of time, we'll go ahead and leave it there. Actually, before we go, Jesse, and I sincerely appreciate your time. This has been an incredible interview. I know what your take on the dollar is. I'm going to assume that you're bullish gold, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. So what do you think about precious metals, commodities, and Bitcoin?
Very bullish on gold longer term. In the short run, I think gold's probably due for a correction. Real interest rates are rising now, which is not a good environment for gold. But I do think longer term, it could go much, much higher. Bitcoin, the problem I have with Bitcoin is... I agree with the crypto nerds, whatever you want to call them, in every respect, except that crypto is a store of value. I do not believe crypto is a legitimate store of value. I think gold is you know, much better in that respect, and really the only proven store of value in an environment like this. So, bullish gold longer term, kind of cautious short term, and not, I mean, no comment on Bitcoin.
What do you think of commodities, oil, uranium? Do you have a view on those?
Yeah, I mean, if the dollar tanks and we start seeing an inflationary environment, this ratio, commodities have never been so cheap relative to financial assets as they are today. I mean, commodities, so if we're entering an environment over the next 10 years that's bad for financial assets, it's got to be relatively good for commodities. And I am bullish on oil. I was buying, like I said, there was a lot of insider buying in March and a lot of the energy names. I do think that will be a good investment over the longer term. As for a lot of the other commodities, to me, gold and oil are probably my two favorites, the ones I'm most comfortable with. I probably think that the rising tide floats all boats over the next 10 years.
Okay, fantastic. For any of my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, Jesse, where can they go? And please give them the URL for the blog. I don't know if there's a specific URL for that, because that is just absolutely amazing. I loved reading it today.
Yeah, thanks. I do spend a lot of time on Twitter. To me, it's a beautiful place to watch sentiment unfold in real time in the markets.
Yeah.
My Twitter handle's @JesseFelder. And basically, I just tweet a lot of the stuff that I'm reading, a lot of the trends and things that I'm following. The blog is thefelderreport.com. I try and put up like a blog post there once a week and a podcast on occasion.
Okay, Jesse. Thank you very much. And I can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, thanks, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.